listening to the Geeked on History podcast. I'm your geek in chief, host of the show. My name is Nick. And before we get going on today's podcast, I have some really important announcements that I want to front load in this one. They're so important, they need to be done at the beginning of this podcast. So this episode marks our 10th episode so far. So we are now going to have to start counting the episodes with more than two hands. I can't believe I've been at it this long. It's been awesome so far. But however, the 10th episode also means that this is sadly going to be the end of the first season of Geeked on History. I know. It's like watching a baby grow up, isn't it? So bittersweet to be moving on to our next phase of life in this podcast. But don't you fret, because season one is just the beginning. I'm already beginning to compile content for the second season of Geeked on History. And the biggest reason for the changes that I'm about to announce are that we've hit a milestone here on the Geeked on History podcast. We now have 150 subscribers. It's still hard for me to believe. 150 people tune in every week to listen to my cringeworthy voice. So rather than take that as a sign that people love torturing themselves, I'll take that as a sign that people are so hyped on history that they want to hear about these topics every single week. And that's awesome. I don't care why you listen, just that you listen. So anyway, these changes I was talking about we're going to be making. So the first one is the new site layout. Geeked on History has had a not-so-awesome style on the blog, and I've decided to go ahead and rectify that. That already has actually been done. So if you were to go to geekedonhistory.com right now, you're probably going to notice that the blog layout is a little bit different from what it was before. I wasn't quite sure, honestly, whether I was going to like it or not, but now that I've seen it, I like it leaps and bounds more than I like the other one. I think it's much more informative, a lot more clear, the information's right there. Thumbs up. I'm actually doing a thumbs up right now. That's how good it is. And along with the new site layout, I've also added a little donate button in the upper left corner. Now, Geeked on History is free. It's always going to be free as long as I'm in charge of it. But I also recognize that there are certain costs associated with it, and I don't mind paying out of pocket. That's fine. However, if you feel so compelled to donate any amount of money, it doesn't even matter how much. I'm just making it possible for people who want to interact with the podcast in that way to do so. So I'll be taking donations through PayPal, and I'm probably going to add a Bitcoin donation there up in the upper left as well at some point. The podcast is also going to be taking about a three-week hiatus, so I'm hoping that 3 weeks means that we're going to be back on track starting on May the 4th, so look out for the next podcast around that time. I'm also going to be shifting the release schedule a little bit. So normally we've had about a once-a-week release schedule. I usually do it on a Sunday. I'll put it out there so everybody can download it before the weekend ends. But now that we're getting a little bit serious here, with 150 people listening every week, I'm feeling more and more compelled personally to improve the podcast in quality ways, including giving myself more time to do research, and I'd really like to also make the podcast a little bit more interesting to listen to. Personally, I think the topics stand pretty well on their own, but I also recognize that listening to a straight-up podcast with very little other sound going on in the meantime may not be the most interesting way to deliver the information. So I've got a plan. It's going to sound a little bit better when we come back in season two, so you've also got that to look forward to. One of the biggest bits of feedback that I've had, specifically as far as quality goes, is giving a shout out to the sources that I'm using from time to time. So things like statistics, where I might pull a number out and it might sound like I'm just pulling it right out of thin air. Well, in season two, I pledge to do a much better job about actually giving the source for the citation that I make, specifically on things like statistics. So hopefully that's a plus. I will not, however, overload you with those statistics in the midst of the podcast, because I think that kind of makes for a boring listen. Now, the last change that we're going to be making is that this is the last podcast that you're going to hear this particular intro on. I know this is kind of a minor thing, but when you start up the podcast in season two, you're going to notice that the intro music is just a little bit different. Actually, it's a lot different, but it's different in a good way. Friend of the podcast, Brian Hamilton, is good enough to make a custom track to come into, so big thank you for that. Hopefully these changes aren't too drastic for all you listening out there. I think that they're very quality changes, but we'll see how it goes. I'm not opposed to changing things around. You know, I'll keep what works and ditch what doesn't. That's what makes the most sense to me. Anyway, I won't hold you up anymore with these crazy changes that are going to be going on. So let's get on with this podcast. So on today's podcast, I'm going to take you back to the year 1818. We're going to be on the north end of Boston now. So what's going on in the United States right now? Well, the Industrial Revolution is one thing that's going on. Businesses and manufacturing are popping up all over the country in big ways. They have been for a little while now. So the idea of industrialization has already really taken root in the United States, and we're just seeing it grow exponentially at this point. Now, this part of the city that we're in right now, the north end of Boston, is predominantly populated by Jewish, Italian, Irish immigrants, and we're right here on the waterfront. We're standing on a street called Commercial Street. Now, in the background, you may hear the tapping of hammers, some really hard work going on. Well, there's a large structure that's being built right now. All that work is going on at 529 Commercial Street. Well, what's being built right now is a large tank for a company called the Purity Distilling Company. You see, we had to build this tank right away because the president of the Purity Distilling Company ordered a boatload of molasses to be delivered from the Caribbean, and it's on its way here right now. So this tank's got to get built ASAP. But we're going to come back to that in a little while. So if we look around this neighborhood, we're going to see a lot of other things. We're going to see a police station. Oh, there's a fire station over there. There's some warehouses and residential surrounding this entire area. There's also a gas lighting company, so there's all kinds of stuff. And right kind of diagonal, just on the other side of where we're standing right now, there's an elevated road. Maybe you've seen something like this in Chicago. It's a subway. It's just like a subway. It's elevated above the street. Now, if we turn around here and look at the Purity Distilling Company head on, we could talk a little bit more about what this company does. So during this time of industrialization, there are certain substances that are needed in just about everything you make and do in the industrial process. Companies like the Purity Distilling Company make their money by providing some of those substances of a chemical nature. Specifically, their specialty is alcohol. Now, alcohol is a great substance, and I don't just mean to drink either, because alcohol can be used for all kinds of different things, especially when you're talking about industrial manufacturing. And if you remember this year we're in right now, 1818, there's another big thing that's going on, World War I, right? So what else do you need in order to fight a war? Well, you need weapons, obviously, or else you don't have a war. And as it turns out, alcohol is a prime component for a lot of the weapons being made to be sent to the war front in World War I. You need alcohol for things like potassium nitrate, mercury fulminate, improved black powder. So everything from bullets to bombs, you need some form of industrial alcohol. Now, a company like Purity Distilling has got to be able to provide their good at scale to their customers, these weapons manufacturers. So that's why the president of the company had to order this huge barge full of molasses to be shipped up here from the Caribbean, and thusly why he had to build this giant tank that's being built behind us. Got to have a place to take it off the boat, right? So now let's talk a little bit about molasses. What is this stuff? Molasses is this nasty sludge that's created as a byproduct of distilling raw sugars like sugarcane, sugar beets, and processing it into table sugar. So it really is an industrial byproduct in the truest sense of the word. But it was also sold as a baking ingredient. So you didn't have to make alcohol out of it specifically. You could do lots of different things with it. You could use it to cook at a time where candy wasn't really a thing that was so widely available. You could take molasses and make a molasses candy out of it. A lot of people these days will use it in cookies. It's just a really cheap sweetener. It was a cheap sweetener back then. It's still a pretty cheap sweetener. But how do you get the alcohol from the molasses? Well, in order to do any kind of fermentation at all, you have to have some kind of mash. And as it turns out, molasses works really well for that kind of thing. Its high sugar content makes it so that all you really have to do is add yeast, and in the right environment, you can make alcohol relatively easily. You can almost make it on accident with having just a giant bucket full of molasses if you just let it sit out there under the right conditions, which aren't really too hard to achieve. Little warmth, little yeast. Baby, you got a stew going. A stew of booze. So let's jump ahead 1 year. So we're going to be in 1919 now, just in the beginning of the year. So not really too far ahead. January 15th, 1919. Actually, let's go one day before that. Let's go to January 14th, 1919. So check out this giant tank it's all done now. Right now it can hold 2.3 million gallons. It's 50 foot high, which makes it at least as large as most of the full-size tenements that are in this area. I mean, this thing is massive. It sticks way up into the sky. You can see this from the elevated rail line as you round the curve. I mean, the thing is just gigantic. There's really no other word for it. And at this point, all the molasses that was on that boat that was in the harbor is now inside of this tank. Now, if we come up here and look at this tank a little bit, we're going to right away notice there's a lot of problems with it. First of all, we know that the construction of this thing was rushed. It had to be rushed because we already had that ship that was coming up from the Caribbean just a few months ago. And we didn't even have a place to put all that. So as the ship was coming up here, the plan was that we had to have a place to take it off of the ship, or else the ship owner was just going to dump it right into the bay. So all that cargo that the president of the company paid for was all just going to go straight into the water, which would have been an environmental disaster in and of itself, but this is 1919, nobody really is thinking about that. But another great thing for the president of the company was that he was able to just pay for the foundation of the building. He didn't even need to pay to have any inspectors come and look at this thing. I mean, only squares have their buildings inspected. Why throw the money away on that? The president was actually in such a rush to get this thing put together that he didn't even fill it up to capacity with water. He just put about 6 inches into the bottom and declared the thing was good to go. But now that we're right up close to it, you can kind of start to see the thing is coming apart at the seams. And I almost mean that literally. If you look at these rivets right here, you're going to notice that there is some black goo that's starting to seep out from them. It's been seeping for a pretty long time at this point. So originally this thing was its normal steel color, and people had noticed that this thing was leaking a long, long time ago. So the president of the company got some complaints, and he spared no expense to fix it. He painted it gray. Yes, sir, it covered up all those black stains coming out of these rivets like nobody's business. But he still had that problem with his pesky street urchins coming around and sticking their fingers into the molasses that's seeping out and sticking it in their mouths. People would come up with buckets even and collect some of it. Hey, free molasses, am I right? But something sinister is going on inside of this tank. The same substance that we could use to make a buttload of rum through the fermentation process is actually going through a natural fermentation right now. And let me tell you that the process of fermentation can sometimes be a little bit violent. So what's going on inside of this tank currently is a buildup of carbon dioxide coming off of the yeast that's in there eating off the sugar, the byproduct of which is the alcohol that the Purity Distilling Company is trying to distill from this molasses. Now, they weren't doing this intentionally. This was just happening naturally inside the tank. Okay, so let's get out of here because this is kind of freaking me out. It's making this weird rumbling sound. I'm not liking it. Let's take a hike out of here. So what ends up happening with this tank is a disaster, as you probably could tell from the title of the podcast. The next day, on January 15th, witnesses to this event reported that there was a low rumbling and then the sound of machine gun fire. The machine gun fire were the rivets that we saw popping out of their seams as a result of the high pressure inside of the tank, as well as just a general crappy construction overall. And in an instant, a wall of molasses between 8 and 25 foot high, moving at about 35 miles an hour, poured through the streets. And this was a lot worse than it sounds. It's hard for me personally to imagine what being in a tsunami would be like. I've had events where I've been at the beach and the waves are a little bit taller than I am, and that freaks me out personally. I don't know if other people have that kind of, maybe it's an irrational fear, I don't know. But these aren't even tall waves. I'm a pretty short dude. So a wave that's coming at me, it's 6 foot, 5 inches, is going to scare the crap out of me because it's so much taller than I am. And there's nothing you can do either. That much power in water is something I think generally when you look at a wave that's coming at you like that, it's just water, right? Is probably the first thought that crosses your mind. But there's so much power behind a substance even as thin as water that when it comes at you, it might not even seem like a big threat to begin with. But if you had that thought and you were staring down this 25-foot wave of molasses, that was a deadly mistake if you didn't have a place to go. This vat explodes and this molasses just pours out all over everybody in the area. And this is partly residential area too, so don't forget. And this wave is absolute destruction. It comes out with enough force to take buildings off of their foundations. No joke, you can look these pictures up. Engine 31 Firehouse that I pointed out before was just demolished by this wave. It was taken straight up off its foundation and just basically crumbled to pieces. Every structure in this immediate area had significant damage, including that elevated rail line that we had pointed out just across the street. And as this molasses pours out all over people and buildings and pets and vehicles all over the street, it just covers everything. And this stuff is thick, too. It's not water. It's thicker than blood. It's probably one of the thickest liquid-like substances that I can think of right off the top of my head. And when this stuff comes out, it gets everywhere. It finds a way to get into every nook and cranny all up and down this road. And there's enough of this stuff left over after the initial wave that there's a 2 to 3 foot flood of this sticky crap left in the streets for people to be stuck in, wading through just to get out. You couldn't swim in it. I mean, you would probably drown yourself. It would keep you down. And if we look back at the photos of this time, Thank goodness we left, right? Because there's mangled girders all over the place. There's metal that was bent as a result of the initial wave that had come crashing down. And there are people hurt and killed, to be sure. But the fact that this 2 to 3 foot flood of stuff is still in the road means that any rescue effort that's about to come through here is going to be severely hampered by the fact that they could barely move through this stuff. So in terms of numbers, we're talking about 21 people killed. Mainly they were crushed by the initial wave that had come down just as the thing burst open. But there are also 150 further people injured. And part of the issue here was that so many of these people that were dead and injured were so covered in molasses that the rescuers couldn't even really find them. It's this black substance. If you're covered in it, it's really hard to tell what the difference between a piece of floating wood from one of the damaged buildings nearby and an actual human body that needs help. It's hard to tell the difference between those things and the sludge. The ages of the victims that were killed in this disaster are between 10 and 76 years old. The two youngest were Pasquale Iantosca and Maria D'Estacio. The oldest was 76 years old, Michael Sinnott. And the cleanup for this thing is a very tall order. Crews had to pump water out of the harbor and sprayed it all over the streets just to thin out this thick substance. All told, it took 87,000 man-hours to clean the entire mess, according to a book published in 2004 by Stephen Puello called Dark Tide, The Great Boston Molasses Flood of 1919. So even just to get the stuff off the road took a very long time. That was with 300 people, too, pitching in. So obviously, in any kind of disaster like this, people start to point fingers of blame almost immediately. And because this time is so ripe for businesses and so low on accountability for business owners, the company had a pretty easy time of just, the Purity Distilling Company had a pretty easy time of just distracting the audience to look at a different group of people to blame. Initially, they blamed the anarchists, which really probably would have been a pretty good argument. This is right around the time of the first Red Scare. The explosions that people heard as the vat burst open could have easily been mistaken for a bomb. TNT was the anarchist's weapon of choice. And you also had a pretty famous duo called Sacco and Vanzetti that happened just a year later in the same state, in the same city in South Braintree, Massachusetts. So this was an absolutely plausible situation to have happen. But some people weren't really buying it. And in one of the first ever class action lawsuits in Massachusetts history, which was filed on behalf of the Boston Elevated Train Line, questions were going to be asked directly to Purity Distilling on their practices in business. Now, the Boston Elevated train line also had skin in the game because, you remember, they had a train line that was damaged by the wave of molasses that came out of this vat. They're seeking losses and damages against Purity Distilling for what probably could have just equally been negligence, as far as anybody knew. And so they hired an MIT civil engineering professor named Charles Spofford to do some investigation on the construction of this tank. And what Spofford found was that the tank had been overfilled and was not built well. We'd already really gone over this, though, right? I mean, we know that the rivets were leaking. The court ruled 6 years later, after this whole incident had taken place. But it's clear now that the tank to hold this molasses was built in a hurry, and it was not built well. Things like fermentation just hadn't been taken into account. Now, the Purity Distilling Company did take responsibility in so much as paying the businesses for their losses in out-of-court settlements and payments to the victims' families. According to a 2006 article in the Chicago Reader, Purity Distilling paid out $600,000 in out-of-court settlements to businesses who took damage. That's about $10.7 million today. And they also paid about $125,000 in today's money to each victim's surviving family. That's according to the Smithsonian. Maybe $125,000 is a pretty low price to pay for somebody's life, considering that so much negligence had taken place at Purity Distilling that year. But nevertheless, you can take that as an admonition that Purity Distilling was guilty of negligence. So you can actually still go back to this place today. It's still there in Boston. The company is not there anymore. The vat is gone. And instead of repurposing it for commercial use, today it's being used as a park. It's called Langone Park. There's actually a baseball diamond there, so you can go see that. And there's a nice plaque that commemorates the victims of this very strange disaster. Very strange, but with real consequences. And local legend says that if you go down to Langone Park on a hot summer day, you can still smell the molasses as a result of that awful, terrible flood in 1919. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. I really hope you all enjoyed Season 1 of the Geeked on History podcast. And I also really hope that you stick with me. So hopefully, when we come back in Season 2, you all will be really interested in talking. I'm looking forward to even more community interaction. I still want to hear from you guys, so feel free to send me an email at nick@geekedonhistory.com. That's nick@geekedonhistory.com. That's my email. Don't forget to visit the site, geekedonhistory.com. That's where you can find the blog. We have a Twitter, so don't forget to follow that. And I'd really, really, really appreciate it if you took a couple seconds out and reviewed and rated the podcast on iTunes. Trust me, I read all this stuff. I love hearing the good and the bad. Any kinds of comments whatsoever, I will definitely read it, and I'll do my best to respond. So maybe the next time you go in and download one, just hop on over and give it a quick review. And like I said, looking forward to the next season where we're going to have even more discussions about history, and hopefully an even more entertaining format. So keep your eyes open, your ears listening, and I'll see you all next season. Oh, and one more thing. Don't forget to stay geeky. I'll see y'all later.